Hey gang, this is Roger Joseph Manning Jr., and you are currently listening to The Vinyl Guide with your host, Nate Goyer.
Oh, well, thank you for that, Roger. And hey everyone, it's Nate, host of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for joining us here this week. As you've heard, we are welcoming Roger Joseph Manning Jr., musician, songwriter, arranger, hired studio gun who's part of Beck's band and has appeared in several hundred recordings and songs and albums by the likes of Adele, Roger Waters, Johnny Cash, Fiona Apple, Pink, and heaps more. He's also a founding member of Imperial Drag and Jellyfish, bands I absolutely love. Spilt Milk is one of my favorite all-time albums. It's absolutely gorgeous and still being rediscovered by people this very day. We'll talk about all of this today with Roger, including his latest solo EP, Glamping, which was on Pledge Music. However, he now has his solo catalog available on vinyl at bandware.com. It's a long URL. I'll put the link in the episode page. Up there, you can get a copy of Catnip Dynamite, The Land of Pure Imagination, and even the new Glamping EP will be able to be purchased up there on vinyl. Plus, I'm going to be playing a track from the Glamping EP on today's show, a track called Operator that I guarantee is going to be rolling around your head for the next week. It's awesome. And whether you have a purple vinyl pressing of Glamping or a green reissue of the Jellyfish masterpiece Spilt Milk, you'll need to keep your record clean. And what better way to do that than use the Groove Washer record cleaner? Now, I don't know about you, I don't have the type of money to purchase one of those automatic record cleaners, and from what I understand, they keep overheating and breaking down anyway. I use the Groove Washer, which is a manual cleaner. Just spray the G2 fluid on the record surface and remove the dust, gunk, and debris from the vinyl, simultaneously making your record sound better and your equipment last longer. Now, your local record shop may sell the Groove Washer. You can ask them for it, but don't accept a cheap substitute. You can always go to groovewasher.com, and if you do, here's a 10% off coupon. Use checkout code VINYLGUIDE10 and get 10% off anything at groovewasher.com. The best manual record cleaner in heaven, hell, or earth, the Groove Washer, 10% off everything with checkout code VINYLGUIDE10 at groovewasher.com. And for those of you new to the Vinyl Guide podcast, we have a ton of episodes and interviews available to download and listen to for free at any time at thevinylguide.com. Episodes like our interview with guitar legend Joe Satriani, episode 106 of The Vinyl Guide, episode 176 featuring Scott Gorham of Thin Lizzy and Black Star Riders is available at thevinylguide.com. We partied with Andrew WK, and you can listen in episode 130 of The Vinyl Guide, Miles Kennedy of Alter Bridge and Slash's solo project, episode 128, Ian Anderson of the legendary Jethro Tull, episode number 119 of The Vinyl Guide, Mike Portnoy, Sons of Apollo, Neil Morse Band, Dream Theater, and more, episode 116. Zach Wilde of Ozzy Osbourne's band and Black Label Society, episode 114 of The Vinyl Guide, and heaps more. Go to thevinylguide.com, or you can download the episodes through our digital apps at the Apple or Android store. Just search for The Vinyl Guide, download for free, and enjoy for a lifetime. So let's hear a track from the Glamping EP, and then get straight into the Vinyl Guide interview with Roger Joseph Manning Jr.
Operator, I need you
All right, so today on The Vinyl Guide, we have Roger Joseph Manning Jr., a musician, producer, an analog and audio nerd. Is that fair to say, Roger?
Well, let's see. Yeah, I mean, all the above. I don't know that. I love analog to death. That's what I was raised on. That's what the cells in my body are used to responding to. The digital information hitting my body and eardrums is, it always feels foreign. And it takes real artistry for somebody to warm the stuff up and try to get it back to that home base known as analog. And there's many talented engineers out there who can do that. It's still not my preference. My preference is to have all of the traditional recording gear from the 60s and 70s, including tape machines, and have it pressed to vinyl, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I just prefer how that sounds. Mm-hmm. I prefer synthesizers that are constructed that way and outboard recording gear and tape decks that are made that way versus everything else that we all use now out of convenience. But I will, you know, use whatever it takes to get to the finish line. Certainly some projects have much more of a time deadline on them, but given the luxury and given the budget to do it the old fashioned way, so to speak, that's just only because it sounds better to me. I mean, that's the only reason. If digital sounded better, that's where I would hang out.
If we look back, say, you know, 20 years ago now at some of the digital recording options like ADAT or some of those sort of things, there was a clear difference between that and the analog tape machines and those sort of things. But now technology seems to have advanced quite a bit in so many different areas. Are we closer to having digital capabilities that will be hard to discern from analog?
We're closer, but baby steps. I think in 10 to 20 years, I'll probably be on my way out from this earthly plane. They'll get all the resolutions so, so high, they will literally clone in terms of simulation. I mean, that's just what I've been told by tech heads. And, you know, the CPU speed and all those factors that contribute to getting the resolution high enough to reproduce what analog tape does when the signal hits it, they'll be able to reproduce that. And they keep, you know, every few years, they do another version that mimics that. I mean, that's the irony of the whole thing. There's very few things, you know, modern popular music, a lot of, you know, EDM, techno, hip hop, top 40, whatever, they kind of have no problem sitting in the digital domain, and that whole genre is at peace with it and built around it. I mean, it was very fashionable a few years ago to put your record out using GarageBand. Well, for that audience's ears and preferences, I guess, and their values, that works for them. But all the people designing outboard gear, there's so many companies that are cloning all the stuff that they basically use in the 60s and 70s and early 80s to make records. Mm-hmm. In a way, it defeats the purpose. I mean, I get it, but you're better off using the old clunky hardware,
right?
Because it's going to sound better until they get the resolution up, versus genres that have no problem being specifically, that they embrace whatever digital technology is today, and they use it as their medium, their sound palette. Mm-hmm. You know, whereas we're still trying to recreate Abbey Road 1968, and we're failing miserably, but every couple of years we get closer and closer.
So what do you think it is? Because I've had many people here on the show, and we talk about vinyl, and we talk about analog, and most of the conversation revolves around these, I'll call it non-scientific notions about analog being better and the sound being warmer and things like that. Do you know of any science or any sort of facts that would support why we all seem to love the sound of analog more than a digital reproduction?
No, I mean, I've read a handful of articles and the side. I don't have a mastery or an interest in going back and understanding the science the way, say, Tom Dowd would have been able to, you know, who had one foot in MIT science and one foot in the recording process, hands-on. But all I can say is it's again, it's what our ears are picking up. I don't know the science behind it. You know, you get a feeling from your ears into your physical body. It's right. It's frequencies massaging frequencies, and our human makeup responds to a certain thing. So if I'm sitting there talking to somebody saying, "I love what happens when a vintage Rickenbacker '60s bass pumps through an EMI console, hits tape, is compressed with a Fairchild, that gets pressed to vinyl, and then I play in my living room through a Macintosh tube stereo system." There's so many chains of events, but at the end of the day, that feels good in my system. It's highly visceral. And then you take my nephew, who's 16 years old, and he stands in front of a different stereo system with different low-end information coming from a synthesizer that Calvin Harris programmed in his computer using whatever plugins he used to manipulate the sound or not. It's just a straight virtual analog synthesizer. My nephew has no point of reference for what was. Just like many people today have no idea what it's like to stand in front of, say, a 21-piece jazz orchestra that Stan Kenton or Duke Ellington would have been conducting, and what it feels like to hear an upright bass and trombones and low information coming off of a stage. That's now a dying, you know, generational experience. So part of it comes from it is absolutely generational. I can't tell my nephew that he's missing anything, because as far as he's concerned, when he hears modern computer-based music hitting his body, he's none the wiser. He's completely, I assume, he's completely gratified. He's satiated. I sit and listen to the same music, and I feel half full. It's half empty. I'm not getting a total experience what I have been conditioned to growing up. And that's all it is. Just my grandfather would listen to the Beatles with me, and he'd go, "I don't know why these guys always got to be screaming all the time." Well, of course, it sounded like screaming to him. It didn't sound like the crooners of his day, you know. So it's so much of that is what's going on. We can sit and debate the physical science of it, and one's better than the other. But at the end of the day, it's, you know, what were you massaged with in your mother's womb? What were the first 5 years of your life? What was hitting you? And for a lot of people in my age group, what was hitting me was the Ed Sullivan Show coming through my dad's, you know, television, black and white television. And then he'd go and play a Simon Garfunkel record off his reel-to-reel tape or vinyl with his whatever the stereo system was he had at the time. And that was my that's what informed me. That's what massaged my body. That's what kind of babysat me orally. So the more you leave the womb, right, the further we're always trying to get back to the comfort of that womb. And for so many of us, that comfort zone, that nurturing, that loving sensation was accompanied by analog technology, period. You know, and then of course there's young kids who did not grow up with analog. They've grown up with digital and studied it and are masterful engineers. They may go back and be reintroduced to the warmth of tube gear, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they may actually have a change of heart. But that change of heart only came through education. They sat down, spent their time going, "Wow, I have given this old Pink Floyd album on vinyl through a stereo a chance to affect my system." And you know what? Lo and behold, it's affecting me in a more positive, it's more gratifying to me, in a way that anything coming off of current radio is.
In my experience, a lot of that needs to be introduced from someone to be able to say, you know, you've been listening to music through earbuds or through the computer or other means. Let's sit down, let's have a vinyl experience. And those sort of influences can create that spark of interest that'll hopefully carry them into exploring it further.
Sure.
Did you have a highly musical family?
No.
No?
Okay. Not at all. In fact, as I get to know other friends and acquaintances and music makers, I'm kind of appalled at how nothing gets my folks or their culture or their environment. But I'm kind of appalled by how little music was in my house, as well as how few books were in my house. Mm. It was a pretty, as far as culture in my home, it was pretty much spoon-fed to us by the three television networks and the two AM radio stations. So I got the same schooling as my entire peer group. And somewhere in junior high, found myself ravenous and hungry for something else. And thankfully, there were big kids and older people who slowly but surely would introduce me to things. And when we had a car, we were able to drive from our suburban San Francisco Bay Area community, which was basically farmland, into Berkeley, into San Francisco, into the Bay Area, where there was endless culture of all kinds. And I started being exposed to different flavors in all realms of the arts and could not get enough. I was insatiable. I was like, oh my God. You mean this has been hiding over the hill? Good Lord.
I've been missing this all my life. What were some of the records that really kind of gave you those aha moments?
Well, it started out very slowly and obviously with pop rock that was slightly more intricate and massaged that intellectual, architectural constructionist in me, which was basically entry-level stuff like Chicago, Toto, Steely Dan, any of the pop bands that were slightly more progressive, Doobie Brothers. And then that graduated into progressive rock and fusion itself. So yes, Genesis, King Crimson, and all the fusion bands of the day, anything Chick Corea, Herbie Hancock, John McLaughlin were doing. And then that coincided simultaneously with the late 70s, early 80s, new British invasion in the form of synth pop and, you know, early post-punk indie rock stuff. So Peter Gabriel, that whole world. I mean, I thought the world was going to be like that forever. I thought bands like Blondie and Talking Heads and Peter Gabriel and B-52s were going to go on forever. Like the Devo. I mean, wow, they're in the top 40, but they're kind of weird, man. They're fucked up. They have a twist. Now, this doesn't sound like Chaka Khan and Janet Jackson, you know, I long for that variety in my top 40, but I don't want to digress.
I don't know if you had this experience or not. I've got a lot of folks that come on the show and we talk about their musical awakenings, and a lot of people that are from the generation before me point to the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. I've got a very similar experience, but with Devo on Saturday Night Live.
There you go.
That
bam
moment as a kid watching that, and I forgot how old I was, probably 8 or 9 or something like that. There was everything that I knew before that moment, and then everything after that moment was different.
For sure.
I guess when you talk about your musical influences, one of the things that surprises me, especially after hearing your music for so many years, you seem to have a theatricality to your music. Did you ever get into any of the composers, any Gershwins or Rodgers and Hammerstein or anyone like that?
Well, you're absolutely right. I've even come to see how much my pop actually is musical in its nature, albeit it's got more rock in it, but we certainly lived through Godspell and Jesus Christ Superstar in that world. But you're absolutely right. So I know a lot of the classic Broadway composers through my jazz studies, not because I was a fan of musicals. In fact, to this day, I'm peripherally a fan of musicals. They're just a little too, well, for lack of a better word, cornball and corny and just that whole kind of theater thing. It's often too silly, and I like my music to rock out more and be a little bit more sentimental. Let's see, the way jazz gave us that world versus how Broadway gave us that world, or the way the progressive rock gave us that world, and theater. or even a band like Marilyn Manson, who I enjoyed because they were so theatrical. In other words, their theater was as important as the music or whatever. But, you know, I mean, all some of the best composers of the 20th century, in my opinion, certainly from a pop standpoint, were in theater. You know, Stephen Sondheim, Rodgers and Hammerstein, like you said, Cole Porter, Jerome Kern. I mean, it goes on and on. I mean, the guys at Disney, the Sherman Brothers, who worked for Disney for ages, all that stuff to me is it's the ultimate. You know, you've got 60 years or so, 7 years of golden moments of people understanding harmony, and all the jazzers did. So Gershwin, right? Just like you mentioned, he understood jazz harmony. He was a master of it. But he and his brother were also obsessed with melodic hooks. And this is the school that McCartney was the first to admit he learned from. Mm-hmm. Now, Lennon, not so much. That's not Lennon. Lennon was into the leather. You know, he was into the blues rockers from America. And that, as was Paul, you had to be. You were a teen. That's how rock appealed to you in its infancy. But McCartney also had the added bonus of studying what I guess was called music hall tradition in the UK, which was basically their Broadway. Mm-hmm. And all you have generations of composers who are basically trying to out sing each other. They're trying to write, I can write a better melody than you. I can write a catchier, hookier melody than you. I can write a more lyrical, romantic, sentimental melody than you. That was the goal. Cut to the times we're living in now, I can write a better trap beat than you. My groove and my programming on an MPC is premier, and my rhyming of non-melody poetry is premier over melodic content. I'm not diminishing that. I'm just saying these are the times we live in versus what was the norm and what you had to do to be a top five smash hit songwriter in the 40s, 50s, 60s. Bacharach is a beautiful evolution of that because he was coming out of that jazz tradition of jazz harmony and progressive time, but still had to make it catchy, dancey, sentimental. He teams up with an unbelievably wonderful and innovative lyricist. But he wants to take things and he wants to modernize things. So all of his compositions with Dionne Warwick and then the people who would go on, hundreds of people who would go on to cover his songs in the 60s and 70s, you're seeing this modernization of jazz tradition. So it doesn't sound as swing and hokey as maybe our grandparents' music did. Mm-hmm. There's a modern, and this is why you have bands like the Carpenters covering his stuff, because it almost had like a youthful element to it. And these are the kinds of things that really turned my ear on growing up as a songwriter. So you could almost say I was learning about progressive jazz harmony and highly involved melodic content through groups like the Carpenters, who were channeling it via Burt Bacharach, who was channeling it via Sinatra and Duke Ellington and those masters and Broadway masters, like you said.
You've been involved in so many different artists, and there seems to be a familiarity in these projects that you work on. When I heard Glamping, it was clear in the first 6 seconds that this song was related to your past work. How do you describe your musical and songwriting style?
Well, I'm pretty humble about the whole thing. I listen to a lot of stuff, but really, as a songwriter, right, I've got my 5, 6, 7, 8 artists that really have inspired me and that are my heroes. And I live to continue to write stuff as good as them. In other words, any one of their songs that inspired me, I just want to do something that profound. Okay. So fortunately, I think after doing this for a while now, I have my version of it. You know, you might hear Todd Rundgren for a second or 10cc or any number of my inspirations, but I think at the end of the day, I've got my twist on it. Now, I'm basically making my statement, but in a classic, in a school of classicism. I'm not really trying to reinvent the wheel here. I'm simply trying to offer up more high art, offerings that can hold their own amongst my peers. And I'm very flattered when my fans give me those types of compliments, because I can pretty much guess what their record collections are like. And so that's all I've ever tried to do in Jellyfish or any of my various artistic offerings, and certainly in my solo work. And but I continue to try to surprise and impress myself, which ultimately I believe will surprise and impress my fans.
Do you sometimes throw out songs that you're working on or bits that you're recording because you feel they sound too much like one of your influences? Like, oh, this is way too 10cc. I need to tone this down a bit. Do you find yourself in that situation?
Well, yeah, sure. I usually go for broke and then rein it back in. And you're absolutely right. Part of being studied is knowing what all the Beatle entrapments are, for example, because you had to learn the Beatle entrapments to begin with, to study your craft. And so it's pretty easy for a warning light to go off, and it's mostly not so much that's referencing something. It's more like, no, you're basically ripping it off. You can't do that. Mm-hmm. And nor would I want to. And I'm very weary. I think what's great about writing as long as I have, and certainly, you know, like Elvis Costello comes to mind. Here's a guy who I know who he's studied for the most part, but you just you mix it up so much that finally at one point it comes out just sounding like you. You can't really go, oh, he's copping the Beatles there, he's copping whoever there. Mm-hmm. For example, I forget what there's two songs that Brian Wilson admittedly says, I was listening to Burt Bacharach, and then I walked over to the piano and I wrote these two songs. And if I were to sit there and analyze them, which I have, I can see him going for Burt Bacharach style chords. But by the time it's coming out of the Brian Wilson filter, it doesn't sound like that. It doesn't sound like he's stealing a Burt Bacharach song. And I think you just have to be cognizant of those types of things and just be self-aware enough. And I think I am self-aware enough because I suffer from what a lot of writers suffer from. I'm hyper insecure and hypercritical because I just have an insanely high standard, as my partners have who joined me over the years, for what we want to finally then release to the public. And we take great care with that. That's one of the reasons that it's challenging for me to listen to, you know, somebody who's put out an album and they've been writing songs on their acoustic guitar for 3 years. And I'm just listening to it going, have you ever sat down with a Dylan record? Because right now you're basically out of your ignorance. You're doing Dylan, but because your voice sounds different, someone's giving you a record deal. And that doesn't interest me. Now, that's all a moot point because that person may be connecting with a huge fan base and they're doing just fine career-wise. But in my opinion, they're not forwarding songwriting craft, or they're not pioneering or taking things to a place. I was a big fan of the Police when they hit, and it was no mystery to me to learn that the three of those members brought to the table years of study and craftsmanship, even though they were doing essentially fun party dance sing-along teenage rock music. You know, that's what they were doing. Sting was a studied jazz head, as was Stuart Copeland, of progressive rock, art, very arty type stuff. And Andy Summers, he was the eldest. He'd been in all kinds of British blues bands and all types of things, but they had an objective. And so I cite them as an example because on the surface, their music was three chord pop, but it's so well crafted and put together with years of study and craftsmanship and intellectual seasoning, and it's absolutely high art in my opinion, and it's classic, and it has stood the test of time.
Now, you mentioned you're extremely critical of yourself and very discerning of your work. Do you hear the mistakes, or when you listen to your past work, do you have that critical ear on? Are you hard on yourself, or are you still very proud of that music and you can appreciate it for what it is?
Mostly, I can appreciate it for what it is. I don't, you know, well, we'll take Jellyfish, for example. Andy and I were as hyper-aware and hyper-critical as we could possibly be at that time in our lives and at that age. And being studying musicians who were only 23, 20, you know, we were in our early 20s. So when I listened back to those recordings, and I remember Andy and I mulling over every detail because we're like, this is it. You know, not going to get a second chance here. We're about to hand it off to the world. Can we stand by this? And we always promised ourselves we had to be able to stand by it 100%, because whether or not the press liked it, whether or not our friends liked it, whether or not family liked it, whether or not our girlfriends liked it, we had to look each other in the eye and go, this is blowing our minds. So I don't give a damn what the world says. It's going to be real nice if the world likes it, because then they're all going to come to the party, and they're going to come to the party with their spirit and souls and their pocketbook, which is going to mean we can do more and more and more of this. But ultimately, it's not going to crush us emotionally, and our egos are not going to be hurt because we believe in this. And that's how I've always tried to operate. So when I hear Jellyfish recordings now, I just go back and go, well, at 25, I didn't understand that I could do this, this, and this with the background vocals. I hadn't studied this, this, and this with violin or, you know, string arranging, and I would have changed this, this, and this. And that would be, it would have possibly improved my vision and my contributions to those songs. And I'm still okay with what we offered up.
Mm-hmm. Would you ever consider doing not a remix, but a revisitation of some of the Jellyfish work?
No, because I respect all the circumstances that went into those final versions, and those final versions are what the fans have fallen in love with. I see no benefit whatsoever to attempting to mess with history and mess with time that way, because it's perfect in what it is. I could sit there and hyper-analyze it and critique this and that and the other, but that's with the benefit of perspective of time. Hindsight's 20/20. But ultimately, it's a sculpture that's set in time, and I do not see any benefit to attempting to one-up it. I frankly don't like when other artists do that. Mm-hmm. I think it's a disservice to the piece of art.
Now, what you just described in terms of the mindset that you had as a 25-year-old young man embarking on a musical career, being protective and ensuring that the music had an authenticity that you and Andy could stand by, that's a pretty mature way of thinking for someone who's in their youth, who's just getting into the music industry and starting their career. There must have been tremendous pressure from other areas to compromise, to move things forward, to not spend as much time in the studio or not worry too much about the details. Was that the case while you were recording those records?
Always. And me and Andy, part of why we got along as collaborators during that project was because we shared a vision and a standard. So when you grow up with a band like Steely Dan, who makes masterpiece after masterpiece after masterpiece, not only as songwriters, but certifiably the majority of the record-making industry, engineers, craftsmen, record company people, A&R people, agents, managers, would all agree the Steely Dan were top craftsmen in every aspect of those albums. When you grow up with those types of records being the industry standard, and they get played on the radio and they sell millions of copies, then we were products of that. We looked at each other and go, well, why the hell would we want to do anything less? If anything, we'd want to try to match that and one up it. Isn't that the penultimate goal here?
Sure. But Steely Dan had their career going. Queen had sold millions and millions of records. here's this young band Jellyfish. How are you able to convince the powers that be that you were needing this same level of time in the studio, the same level of investment? Zappa calls it, you know, adding the eyebrows. Those records are full of little surprises that really make the character wonderful. How are you able to circumnavigate those objections and really make some incredible records?
Well, fortunately, we made those two records at the tail end of the classic record industry as we knew it and grew up with it. So we had A&R people and record company presidents who believed in us before they signed us, and so opened the purse strings for the most part to make the record that our vision required. So for the most part, you know, the first album, I'm not gonna say we had unlimited support and funding, but it was, well, any band getting signed back then had 10 times the budget records are being given now for new bands. Mm-hmm. A tried and true band like artists like Adele or something is going to have pretty much open purse strings. But any new signing or even a band that's not selling very, very well, I don't know how they get anything done. I don't know how anybody gets paid. I mean, I do because I play on a lot of them. But it's a challenge and a half. So we were very supported, and there was, although Andy and I believed tremendously in our producer who had made many classic hit albums in the 70s and 80s, as well as our engineer who'd worked on many classic successful albums with great, great producers, although we had their support and knew that they could help get us to these heights, Andy and I, at the end of the day, believed we, at the end of the day, were going to sleep with ourselves. We could only trust in ourselves. If there was anybody who was going to be blamed at the end of the day for a record that we weren't happy with, it was going to be us. We were never going to be able to point the finger at somebody else and blame them for a record we were unhappy with or that we didn't believe in. We accepted full responsibility. So we, oftentimes, in our persistence of vision, came across as not having fun, came across as not being lighthearted enough, came across as being too one-sided, came across as being too bossy and unwilling to bend and be flexible. And often you could sum it up, well, it's Roger and Andy, it's their way or the highway. You know, that was the double-edged sword. That was the downside to making records with us, because we were not going to look. We had friends that got signed to major labels and then got dropped like after the album was finished, or their A&R guy gets fired and they're never heard from again, or they make one record, it doesn't sell through and they get dropped. And we're just like, this shit is so fleeting. And this is our one chance. We are not going to fuck this up, and we're not going to let anybody else fuck it up for us. We, you know, and to the, at the end of the day, I feel that our albums were absolutely given a fair chance at radio and MTV and in the press, and they sold what they sold, and ultimately the public said yay or nay. But I do not feel that Jellyfish did not have more success or didn't sell through more because we delivered shoddy albums. We delivered the albums that we wanted to deliver. And I'm thankful for that.
There certainly must be a level of satisfaction you have that the records are continually being rediscovered.
Yes, I am always looking for ways to further that. One of the joys of making these solo pieces over the years, and certainly encouragement to finally get Glamping out after 10 years, was that I would get emails and just Facebook, whatever. I'm not really on Facebook, and I would find out about, oh, here's two teenage girls in Argentina who want to know when you're doing new music again, because they just discovered Jellyfish. And I'm like, these people weren't even born when those records came out. How is this happening? And it's been so amazing. I'm going, and the biggest mystery is, why is this music connecting with them? How is it connecting with them, but not all the other girls at their high school? It's such a mystery and a beautiful mystery, and excited me to it was going to be so challenging to finish 12 songs. So like, well, damn it, let's finish four. Let's get something out there. Let's do this fan funding experiment, mm-hmm. which I'm happy to say went very well. And I'm very excited to now get on with making more solo music because I kind of have a model in place that seems to be working in a new way for me. So that's just been fantastic.
Well, the Glamping EP is wonderful, and I'm sorry that it's only four songs at this point, but I'm looking forward to the rest. When do you think there will be an extended version beyond an EP?
That's a tough call, but I'd like to say within the year. The reason it's a tough call is not because of all the wonderful freelance work that I have slowing me down that I'm eternally grateful for, but because I'm happy to say that Eric Dover and Tim Smith, who were in the second version of Jellyfish, and Eric Dover, of course, who I was in Imperial Drag with, the three of us are making a new record together. We have written and recorded, we've halfway recorded 14 songs, and are just in the process, the slow and arduous process of completing the recording of that, because Tim lives in Atlanta and we're all busy with separate things. And our next recording session is in November and we're just going to keep inching forward, but I couldn't be happier with how the material is turning out.
Wow. So will that be a Roger Joseph Manning Jr. project, or will this be a band yet to be named?
Band yet to be named. Absolutely. And we will hopefully draw in our cumulative fan base, certainly Jellyfish being one of those fan bases, and give the public some more colorful sing-along pop mm-hmm. in this kind of wheelhouse.
Can I suggest a name?
Always.
How about the Nun Punchers?
That's awfully violent.
Okay, well, just sit with it. Just sit with it. See how it goes. So Glamping is your first project after 10 years or so. And you tend to, if looking at your career, you do a lot of collaboration with Andy and Jellyfish and Eric and Imperial Drag, of course, working with Beck. Is it comfortable for you to step out on your own? Is it different for you not working necessarily with collaborators to do solo projects?
No, it's the easiest thing in the world, other than I don't play every instrument. So keyboards and drums come fairly easily to me. But I'm an incredibly slow bass player, guitar player, and I certainly don't. You know, I used to play trombone, but I haven't kept any of my brass chops up or anything like that. So I have to bring outside players in for those instruments. I can play guitar and bass, but it's very slow. I enjoy the solo process because I hear everything in my head very, very fast, which anybody working on their own solo budget will tell you they do. It's actually physically getting it into the recording, on the tape, so to speak, that's the slow, challenging part. Mm-hmm. I don't miss the collaboration at all. In fact, working solo helps balance it out because no one's ever editing me. I'm never compromising. There's never a democratic vote. And so for better or for worse, you get this unedited version of my soul just splattering all over the recording. That's what I used to love about the Todd Rundgren solo albums. Now, those things aren't for everyone. Some people prefer when Todd produces other artists or when he does his Utopia band. I try to get good results no matter what scenario I find myself in. And there's pros and cons in all scenarios, but I also enjoy all scenarios. The biggest challenge for me is the singing aspect. I've worked with some incredible singers over the years, both in my bands and as a sideman. And getting vocals onto a recording that I stand by and am proud of and that I think hold their own is incredibly challenging for me. I don't have the range I wish I had. I don't have the abilities with my voice I wish I had. And getting my voice to do anything is incredibly challenging. I also don't prefer, as Donald Fagen once could be heard saying, I don't prefer the way my vocal sounds in a recording. I prefer other singers. Tone, it's all, right, we're all born with these unique instruments. Somebody's born with a saxophone or a trumpet or a violin. And while my voice can do things and can convey a melodic thought, often sometimes I'd rather hear somebody else singing my melodies. So that's been, but that's just preference. Mm-hmm. I'm very grateful for all of them.
Is that maybe you just being hypercritical or just?
Yeah. I mean, certainly it's me knowing what the song could be. In other words, if there's a guitar solo in the song, well, who's the right guitar player and what's the right sound for that guitar solo so that it can be the best that it can be. I'm no different with the lead vocal. You know, what's the right tone? What's the right sound? What's the right style? Who's got the right instrument? I absolutely believe my voice does wonderful things and try to maximize that. But often I'll find myself, I've written a song I'm super proud of, and it's time to sing it, and I'm like, oh, dear. My voice doesn't sound as good as I would like it to on this melody, and it's really hard to get my voice to do anything but what it's capable of doing. What I was born with. I can't go and practice different singing style. You're born with a sound.
Mm-hmm. So you love doing your solo work. However, it was maybe 10 years between Glamping and Catnip Dynamite. Why the extended break? I mean, obviously you were doing a lot of stuff with Beck and you know, collaborating with a lot of, working on a lot of other projects, but 10 years seems to be an awfully long time between solo work.
Yeah. I mean, at the risk of stating the obvious and sounding like I'm whining, it's just practical matters. My solo endeavors, let alone the groups I've been involved with, have never been financially lucrative, and frankly, they haven't been sustainable. Mm. So all the joys that I've received from doing solo stuff have not paid for any of my bills. It's all that my outside work has paid for my bills. I know how fortunate I am to be getting up every day and making music for some enterprise and having money come in because of that. And I so value that. I do not take it for granted. And I hustle like crazy to keep a roof over my head and food in my fridge through music, because I have no interest in going back to any kind of traditional workplace to sustain myself. I only ever pursued solo stuff because I was just craving it. And I said, well, I certainly can get something done in between the cracks here. And that's why we got a first solo album in 2006. There have been wonderful little perks here and there that have happened and people's interest, but you have to reach a certain level to then have enough commerce happening where you then can go, oh, I'm just going to get up and do not only write and record solo music every day, but I'm going to then tour it and I'm going to pay a band to support me. And, you know, we're going to do it somewhat smart so that we're not sleeping on people's floors and all living out of a van for the next 9 months. Mm-hmm. I mean, you do that between the ages of 15 and 25. And then beyond that, you start questioning your existence, and you know, it takes great self-discipline to be able to travel and promote yourself with that kind of a meager existence. Mm-hmm. Not to mention personal relationships, and heaven forbid one would want to start a family, which I never wanted to do, so I don't have children depending on me, I don't support a wife. She supports herself. We're both highly independent, and it's a beautiful thing that way. But that allows me freedom to one day play on Morrissey's new record and the next day add another keyboard part to a solo song I've got in the works. Fortunately, we're continuing to look for ways to expand the audience and so that I can provide for myself and give the people more music. That's why the Pledge campaign was such a wonderful experiment in that.
Sure. And as part of the Pledge campaign, you introduced Catnip Dynamite and Land of Pure Imagination on vinyl for the very first time, as well as Glamping is available on vinyl as well. Did you do any special masterings specifically for the vinyl format of those records?
No, I was very happy with the mastering that John Paterno did for all of my solo releases, including Glamping, and simply went with that. I didn't see a need to try to fix something that wasn't broken.
For those of us who may have missed the Pledge campaign, what will be the best way that people can get a copy of Glamping or Catnip Dynamite on vinyl?
I'm currently seeking with my manager other traditional avenues to not only get the glamping CD / vinyl, whatever, you know, another run of those printed, but having, again, additional runs of the solo stuff, mm-hmm. The previous solo records, as well as locking me in for some kind of future releases, and possibly the Eric Roger Tim project too. So we're currently reviewing contracts, meeting with people, talking about what the possibilities are here. And you know, unfortunately, the public is going to have to wait, but it all is happening and will happening. Yeah. It'll be an arrival time at some point, but excellent. That's what we're looking at.
So watch this space.
Yeah.
As we start to wrap things up, you've worked with Beck, you've worked with Ringo Starr, Roger Waters, like I said, Marilyn Manson, Adele, you're on Johnny Cash's last record. You've worked with a lot of folks across the industry. Is there anyone out there that you haven't worked with that you would like to one day add to that roster?
Oh, there's a ton. I mean, you know, Elvis Costello, XTC, McCartney. I mean, I'm just so many of my heroes. And there's certainly current bands that are up and coming or doing quite well that intrigue me. Very often these people do just fine without any outsiders. So it would be fantastic to contribute keyboards, and sometimes I've contributed background vocals or arranging. Arranging is great fun, mm-hmm. string and orchestral arranging. But ultimately, it would be so much fun to write with any of these people. I'm a bit, I must admit, I haven't put the effort out to pursue that. I guess I've just been so busy just trying to maintain and stay afloat with all the things on my plate currently, musically, and then time just slips away.
We can send a note out to Andy Partridge if you want. He's a friend of the show. So
be my guest. But see, that would just be like this indulgence festival. I would not be coming to the party going, you know, Andy, I think what I could offer you if you just listen to what I'm putting forth is that. No, it would be an exercise in, it would just be fun. It'd be as fun as just sitting around singing songs with him, mm-hmm. To throw ideas back and forth. One of my favorite kind of bootleg tapes is the Elvis Costello, Paul McCartney writing sessions of their rough demos, mm-hmm. many of which Costello went on to record and McCartney did too, as you may or may not know. But I love hearing their two brains fusing together for some of those song ideas. And I would just be fascinated to see what would happen if I had that opportunity with some of my heroes.
Well, I hope to see those two. Roger, thank you so much for coming on the Vinyl Guide. And I certainly look forward to a time when you'll have those some tapes with Andy Partridge and Paul McCartney and Elvis Costello and everyone else on your wish list. I do want to remind folks to check out Roger's Facebook page, facebook.com/RogerJosephManningJr. Hopefully soon we'll see some announcements on where we can get Glamping and Catnip Dynamite and Land of Pure Imagination, where we could order the vinyl copies of those. Quick question, Roger. You've got Beck's phone number. Can you send him a text and ask him when we'll see a vinyl reissue of Midnight Vultures?
Sure. I mean, he's very, very, that's an album that he feels was overlooked when it came out. And recently younger generations have seemed to recognize it. And he is so proud of that album. I think he'd be, you know, he wouldn't hesitate at all to figure out ways to repress vinyl on that.
Well, we absolutely love that record. And there has only been one pressing, as far as I know, when it first came out. And copies of that on vinyl go for $200 and $300 and even $400. So I think most of all the rest of the Beck catalog is out on vinyl, thank God. But Midnight Vultures is a glaring gap in that collection. It's kind of like all the Beatles are released except Sgt. Pepper.
Oh, wow. Didn't know that.
Yeah.
Incredible. That's a big mystery.
So let's find out how we can get that to market somehow. So yeah, if you could send him,
plant that seed,
that would be much appreciated. Roger, thank you so much for coming on the show. And again, glamping is fantastic. I'll play a little bit more as we go out of the interview. And thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for thinking enough of me to have me on this show. I know your audience can appreciate all my ranting and proselytizing and soapboxing. And thank you for giving me this forum to spread the word.
Hey, you're always welcome. You're a fellow analog and audio nerd. Drop by anytime.
Thank you, sir.
Oh, man, what a treat. Roger Joseph Manning Jr. here on the Vinyl Guide, talking analog and vinyl and all sorts of interesting stuff. Now, that song you heard earlier, Operator, I bet that's still going through your head. Certainly does for mine. Stays in there for quite a while. So now, if you want to leave that and get a copy of your own, go to shop.bandware.com/collections/Roger-Joseph-Manning-Jr-shop, or just go to the Vinyl Guide, the episode page, and click the URL. That is an ugly URL for anyone to try to type. Go to thevinylguide.com, find this episode page. You'll have a link straight off to where you can pick up a copy of Glamping for yourself, as well as vinyl copies of Catnip Dynamite, The Land of Pure Imagination, and other solo works of his, as well as specially signed test pressings of the vinyl. That's pretty cool. So if you want something personal and unique signed by the man himself, again, the bandware.com site, which you can get to from this episode page. That's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thanks again for tuning in. Please share this episode with your friends. Put it on your Facebook. Tweet it out. If you've got a friend who likes vinyl but may not be into podcasts, show them how they can get access to The Vinyl Guide on their smartphone. A lot of times it's just figuring out exactly how to do that, and that will give them hours and days and hopefully years of enjoyment by doing that. That's it for this week's episode. We'll be back shortly with a brand new one. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @VinylGuide. Until next time, keep spinning.